And one of the actors, like, aren't you even going to ask me to, like, show you my stuff? And he's like, sure, fine, show me your stuff.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
I'm here to make peace. Tell me what I gotta do to make things right.
You could do something, I guess. You could die, Joey.
Hello, everybody. It is Recotopia, episode 115. Today's big recommend is A History of Violence. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidly ho, Cinerinos.
Indeed. And once again, would like to acknowledge Chat, who has come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any small recommends, Aaron?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Oh, but of course I do. Let's kick it off with something recent. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. One of the few movies brave enough to put "of the" in the title twice. It is a continuation of the Caesar saga, the Caesar trilogy, if you want to call it that, that we got earlier. The out of order named Rise, Dawn, and War of the Planet of the Apes. Yep. And this one is set many generations in the future, I believe is what the text tells us. And we follow a new tribe of apes as the apes have been going long enough to kind of separate into different tribes, do different things. And the movie has an interesting task of being kind of an anthology type story within this franchise, right? It's starting with new characters, a new story, all that kind of stuff. And I really, really enjoyed it. I love this franchise. I think there's so many interesting things to say about humanity, ironically, through these apes and kind of their dawning civilization or kingdom, if you will, as it kind of starts. And then how then the humans play a role in that, the humans that are still around. I think this is really well done. I'm always in awe of the special effects in these movies. I just think the motion capture is so good for these apes. This is really, really good stuff.
Something that I sort of intended to try to watch on opening weekend, and I did not get around to it, but I'm eventually going to watch this movie because I like all the other ones as well. I think War is maybe the weakest one, but it was still good. And they said over the weekend that they were planning 9 of these movies. I don't even know if that's I don't even know if that's possible, but
like 5 left or 9 after the original.
Five more after this. I don't know. Who knows? I didn't read the whole thing. Maybe they do mean they have 9 more in store. I don't know.
I wonder if they are trying to get us right up to the OG movies, you know, like when Heston shows up. Like, if that's the case, I wonder how many of the OG movies they're considering canon, because if they're considering the first 2 canon, things get really, really interesting as we get to those later movies, if we find out some things. So, I like the franchise. I'm excited to see what they still have to come.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun that even though we had the writer strike and all that, and we were told that this year was going to be just bereft of movies, they seem to have loaded up quite a few for us this summer. So anyway, on a completely different track, I watched this. This is about the third time I've seen this movie, but it's a great one that I would love to recommend. Big recommend one day, but it's 1955's Diabolique. This movie was remade in 1995. It was not very good, Diabolique follows it's a story of a woman who runs a school and her husband is just like the like the pinnacle of dickiness. He is the worst person in the world. He's abusive in every way to his wife. And on top of that, he's having an affair. And the beginning of this movie shows that the wife knows about the affair and is actually kind of pally with the mistress at the beginning of this movie. And we find out that they are plotting to kill him. And so the whole story is them like trying to come up with a great alibi and a great way to kill him. And it leads to, it leads to them actually drowning him in a bathtub. After they drown him in the bathtub, things start to get really, really weird. They're trying to get away with it. They're trying to dispose of the body. They're doing all these different things. But someone on the school claims that they've seen this guy, the principal, wandering around at times. And is this all one elaborate trick? Did they actually get away with, did they do the murder like they thought they did? What's going to happen? I love this movie so much. It's one of those, I feel like I've even told you too much about this movie because of the way it goes, but that's sort of the plot. That's sort of what I can tell you about this. It's very, very good. I don't know if you've ever seen this, Aaron.
I have. In fact, I watched it yesterday in preparation, cause I knew it was going to be one of your, small recommends. Mm-hmm. And I've been wanting to watch it because one of the things I've heard about it over and over again is that you would swear that Hitchcock made it. Like, it's just, It's that good. Like, it's that well done. And I think all of that is true. This movie is a revelation. It's so, so good. The thriller stuff is so well done. And the plot is so fun and intricate and interesting. And, man, and great performances at the center. I meant to look up who the main actress is, who plays the wife, because I thought she was just absolutely astonishing in this.
It's Vera Clouseau, who I'm going to plead ignorance, but Henri Georges Clouseau is the director. So that's either his sister or wife.
Adds a dark little wrinkle if that's his wife. I found this really, really amazing. I loved this movie.
Henri Georges Clouseau also made the movie The Wages of Fear, which was later remade into Sorcerer, if you guys are familiar with that. And yes, I think Henri Georges Clouseau was sort of known as the French Hitchcock. This is a very good movie. If you're looking for a nice thriller / horror / drama, it's really, really good.
My second small recommend is one I caught recently because a podcast I listened to was going to do some breakdowns of it. And it's George C. Scott in Hardcore from
I've never seen it.
You should see it, Chris. This is a this is a pretty intelligent, I guess you'd call it a thriller. It's kind of a proto Taken in some ways, you know, like the basic idea here is we're in Grand Rapids, Michigan. At a strict Dutch Reformed Calvinist, church. And this family sends their teenage daughter on a trip to Los Angeles to go to, a camp thing for a couple weeks, with the church. And she disappears. And George C. Scott is the dad, and it's up to him to find her. I don't think it's spoiling too much to say she has, transitioned into the world of pornography in Los Angeles. And so if you ever look at the poster for this movie, it's like George C. Scott and then just the tagline, "That's my daughter." And it's like, and you get everything you need to know, as far as the plot from there. George C. Scott is really amazing in this. I know I've heard he was possibly one of the worst actors ever to work with. In some of the history of what people have written about having to work with him, a lot of that had to do, I think, with his alcoholism, I think, is what people have said and those kind of things. But man, is he astonishing in this movie? And I've never seen a movie this seedy that is also really interested in having intellectual conversations about religion. which is like some of the stuff they're talking about, like with the Calvinism and different things like that. I've never heard it go that deep. So it's clear somebody knew what they were talking about. And at the end of the day, it kind of becomes an interesting story about repression and closing yourself off and those kind of things. The only issue I had with the movie is the ending. I think the ending is weak, but the movie itself is really, really interesting and good. So, yeah. Mm.
Okay. Yeah, go. This is something that I need to see at some point. I've heard about this movie for years, and it seemed so campy looking that I just was like, maybe one day. I don't know. But
there's
I've never heard anybody talk about it like this. So I'll have to give this one a look.
I will say there certainly is plenty of camp, and it is funny, both intentionally and unintentionally. So. I think mostly intentionally. I think the movie has comic elements that it's purposefully doing. There's a scene where, not to give too much away, but George C. Scott is, you know, looking for his daughter, finds himself in the position of having to audition porn actors. And one of the actors, like, aren't you even going to ask me to, like, show you my stuff? And he's like, sure, fine, show me your stuff. It's like, so I think the movie knows it's funny, but also it is a bit campy sometimes too. So it kind of can go either way.
My second recommend is also from 1979. It is the movie Stalker, which Andre Tarkovsky did. Some of you may be familiar with a movie he did earlier called Solaris, which was remade, by Steven Soderbergh later on, but, his Solaris is awesome. Both Solarises are actually pretty good, but I prefer the Tarkovsky one. But, Stalker, is about this, it's about a zone in Russia where a meteorite apparently crashed down at one point, and there's been a lot of myth making about the zone. Like, is it dangerous? Is it someplace where you can go and get granted wishes? There's a lot of different things about this zone that people have been sort of speculating on. And it has now become a place where the military is guarding you from trying to prevent you from getting there. But there are people out there called stalkers who are hired to bring people into this zone, and they have to go through sort of a secret maze-like way of getting into the zone. And our stalker here is bringing on somebody who's a writer and someone who's a professor who seem to want something, but their motivations aren't quite clear at the beginning of the movie. And this movie it's long, but it's one of those movies that has just, it's hard to put my finger on why I love this one so much, but cause it's long. There's a lot of like places of dialogue in this movie where the writer and the professor sort of wax philosophical about things. The stalker is very serious. Don't do anything that will upset the zone. Don't do any of this type of stuff. I'm going to take you to this place called the room where you have your wishes granted and everything, but you have to really believe, and you have to really believe. And of course, we're going to find out that there are different motivations at play in this movie. And the stalker himself is the one who is going through a change that the writer and professor never really believed in the first place. And the movie will have you questioning, are there real miracles involved in this? Or is this just a myth that people are constantly reaching out for and will never attain? And so it's got this interesting thing where it's like sepia toned for the first like 10 to 20 minutes. And then once they get into the zone, it's full on color. And it's like it's a sight for sore eyes when it gets to that part. If you want a movie that really makes you think afterwards and just really, you have to really like ponder life and things like that of that nature, this movie is really good.
Yeah. It's one of those movies where you can, like the movie is crafted in such a way that it's almost up to the audience to craft their own meaning to it in some ways, because you can really craft a lot of meaning on top of it. Now, I do think it's saying something specific, at least as far as, you know, I read it, dealing with the idea of hope and optimism and, you know, finding hope in dark places, or, you know, just giving up hope and what that looks like. And, you know, I think the colors is supposed to represent some of that, but it's also about the, I think it's also about the constant like tug and pull we have as humans between the supernatural and the natural. The idea of like, here's what I know to be true because I've experienced it, others have experienced it, we can test it, we've, you know, those kind of things. And here are the things I don't know and I don't understand. And does that mean there's something beyond what we can understand? And like that kind of tug and pull of, you know, figuring that out is, I think, at the core of this movie. But yeah, it's very contemplative. It's, you know, it's almost 3 hours long. So, you know, but I think it's worth, it's a gorgeous movie too. It's shot so beautifully, for sure.
Yeah. And this had a story behind it too, that he shot the movie on this certain film that the Moscow labs couldn't develop it. So he shot a whole bunch of film that that was basically ruined, and he had to reshoot a whole bunch of this and everything. It's kind of there's like a whole bunch of like stories behind the story of making the Stalker. So
interesting.
Yeah. All right. On to our big recommend, which is A History of Violence, and it's Aaron's pick. So Aaron, take us away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
A History of Violence is a 2005 David Cronenberg film. It stars Viggo Mortensen. It's based on a 1997 graphic novel of the same name. The movie starts outside a rundown hotel as the sound of cicadas remind us that it's the summer of 2024, except it's in 2005. Two men emerge from a hotel room road weary and tired and decide to keep heading east and to stay out of the big cities. Their checkout at the hotel goes smoothly, despite some trouble with the maid and a staring contest about who has to go back in and fill up the community gallon jug of water. As the loser heads back in to leave his fingerprints all over every single thing in the entire room, some blood splatter makes us aware that we're dealing with some bad, bad men. But since the movie isn't sure we fully understand how bad they are yet, a child decides to walk into the room to sacrifice their life for our certainty. Smash cut to little Sarah Stahl waking from a nightmare, which apparently in the Stahl household means everybody in the house goes in to check on her and reassure her that monsters don't exist except in forced metaphors about your father's past. The next morning, the family has some baseball talk over some honey bunches of oats, and then Edie takes Tom to work to really hammer home the all-American family in this all-American town. At the diner, which they own, the boys are telling some dating foreshadowing stories before we cut back to Jack's ball game, which is apparently a sport where you stand on third with your foot on the foul side of the bag and prematurely celebrate about hitting into routine pop-ups that end the game. what is going on there?
Yep.
After that, opposing hitter solidifies his grudge for the guy who brazenly dared to catch the ball he hit directly at him. He accosts him in the locker room to put into practice some of the things he learned at the Stephen King School of Being a Movie Bully. But Jack's sense of humor ends up saving him, just like it usually does in the real world. So all is well. Then Edie picks up Tom from work for some classic teenage role play where she puts on a cheerleading uniform, but doesn't even have the decency to put together a cheerleading routine that bothers to rhyme.
Right, God.
Meanwhile, Jack is depressing some girl on a stoop with his nihilism, and when the bully turns a UE to go after him, he just so happens to drive in front of the bad guys from earlier who are now in his small town. Apparently short on cash, they decide to hit up Aragorn's Diner for some good old-fashioned pie-eating and plot-inciting. They decide to go about this in the least stealthy way possible, and after apparently deciding sexual assault was needed before they could do any robbing, Tom saves the day by putting into practice some of the things he apparently learned at the Navy SEAL School of Being a Diner Owner. Tom escapes with just a knife through the foot and a bad case of unwanted publicity-itis. His son is so proud of him that he suggests every teen's favorite show for him to be on, Larry King. Mm-hmm. Larry King.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's the strange vehicle across the street that is giving us all the pause. The next day at the diner, the diner is seeing a post-publicity boom. Ed Harris walks his natural menace through the door with a couple of friends who won't drink a cup of Joe, even though Harris himself is apparently having some mistaken identity issues because he keeps offering up a big old cup of Joey. Eddie calls the cops, who track down Fogarty's vehicle and gives them the lowdown on how bad the baddies really are. The sheriff then makes sure Tom, is who he says he is, because his role in the movie will be expositional small-town cop, and no one is going to stop him from doing it. The next day, before the diner opens, yet another mysterious car is parked out front, and Tom takes off hobbling on his knifed foot while calling Edie to get the shotgun. This is so that she can hold them off until he can fully gump himself back to the house. This kerfuffle will scare his son, whose shock makes him freeze while holding up the biggest spoonful of cereal I've ever seen in movie history. Eventually, the family settles down, and Tom has a heart-to-heart with his son about the mobsters who might be after him. And when his son asks what they do if the mobsters do come, he throws on his shades and says, "Deal with it." The next day at the mall, little Sarah pulls a kids and wanders out of the shoe shop, causing her mom to put into practice some of the things she learned at the diehard school of confronting evil in bare feet. Mm-hmm. When she finds Sarah right near the one-eyed Fogarty, who lays on so much more menace, you'd think he actually had two working eyes. We then cut to the school where Jack has had enough of the bullying, so he instinctively develops fighting skills and pummels Bobby. He tells his dad about it, but his dad just slaps him in the face for thinking that violence was the way to make his point.
Right.
The bad guys with the tinted car windows then show up at the homestead after having picked up Jack, and they want to bring Discount Joey back to Philly so they can mourn the early playoff exit of the Sixers together. After securing his family in the house, Tom goes full Joey Durden and shoots one bodyguard while simultaneously giving complimentary rhinoplasty to the other. Fogarty gets a shot into him, though, but before he can kill Tom, he gets caught monologuing by the son, who Dick Cheney's him through the back.
Boom, 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 boom.
Edie confronts Tom Owie in the hospital about the truth because what she saw convinced him that he was West Philadelphia born and raised, and organized crime is where he spent most of his days. And then 1 hour in, the movie drops the act and he admits he used to be Joey, which was probably pretty evident to any audience member who took the time to read the title of the movie on the poster. Mm-hmm. Joey then tells Sarah that he spent 3 years killing Joey and becoming Tom Stahl, a name he chose for the same reason a stationery salesman owns the website Pen Island. It was somehow available. I'll give you a second on that one. It's a thinker. Jomas returns from the hospital, and his family is now understandably suspicious of him. The local sheriff once again comes out for an expositional meeting where he asks them for the truth, not so much because he really needs it for anything plot-related, but because we need to see Edie stand up for her husband so we can all start the healing process together. The sheriff then heads out, never to be seen again, so Tom and Edie can have some violent makeup sex on the wooden stairs, which wouldn't even make the top 15 on the list of most uncomfortable places characters have had sex in a Cronenberg movie. A mysterious phone call then comes in later that night, where a guy who sounds strangely like the clever version of the guy from Broadcast News asks, "So, your place or mine?" So Joey finally makes the trip to Philly to see how this movie ends, where he gets a beer and then goes to see Richie, who looks strangely like the clothed version of the guy from Body Heat. Yes. After getting through a giant gate, a body frisking, and a reprimand for never banging Jill Levy, Richie and Joey cuddle a bit and start catching up. After William Hurt puts into practice some of the things he learned at the Anthony Hopkins School of completely stealing a movie in 10 minutes of screen time, we learn that these two are brothers with a lot of history. Not so much history that Richie isn't going to kill him, but enough history that he will do it by having someone sneak up on him with a piano wire instead of just shooting him. Then in some of the most simple but clever action this side of Wickdom, Joey efficiently empties the mansion of henchies before shooting his brother in the head so that Richie can make a classic WTF pose as he falls dead. After metaphorically cleaning off his sins in an impromptu pond-side baptism, Tom returns home once again where his family, already mid-dinner, opts for child labor by making little Sarah set his plate. The movie ends as his final look shows us he knows he's welcome back, but may never know if anything ever will ever be the same ever again, ever. And that is History of Violence, Broheme. Mm-hmm. What did you think?
Yeah, I love this movie. And it has a lot to unpack in its hour and a half that that it plays. I was mulling over the title of this because A History of Violence could literally mean our main character has a history of violence. Mm-hmm. But I also think it means on the whole, I think on the whole, it means a chronicle of violence.
Yeah.
Like this is a story about violence, is how violence affects not just one man, but his family and those he touches.
Yep.
The movie shows a whole bunch of different violent acts, and we have the tragic one at the hotel at the beginning, including child murder. And we have there's even small ones like the diner cook relates that story about how his girlfriend then became his wife used to attack him while he was sleeping because she had a bad dream. And then we have the threat of violence from a school bully, Jack is able to deflect by not engaging with the hostility. And we see that making that choice is good for the movie. I don't know if this really works in real life, but for this movie, it's got a point that it's trying to say here, which is, you know, even if he does perform violence here, there's going to be consequences to it. If he tries to do it and he fails, obviously he gets his ass beat up. Mm-hmm. But if he actually comes out and wins, which this movie does later show, there's consequences to that as well. Then there's trying to remember what I was going to say on this one. When Tom stops Billy and Leland from whatever horrible thing that they've planned for the diner, we consider it the violence justified. And then the movie's quick to show that even that kind of violence has its own consequences. Mm-hmm. And it has several prongs to it. And the first is the glorification puts Tom's face in the news. And because he has a gangster past, it brings even more serious and violent men to town. I like, by the way, they keep doing this thing. Remember what Liam Neeson said in The Phantom Menace, there's always a bigger fish. We start with the bully who runs into the two guys in their truck, and the two guys in their truck stare him down. And then those two guys run into Tom, who's even more violently unhinged than they are. And then we get, Carl Fogarty and everybody, them coming in. It's like, there's always a bigger fish when it comes to these violent people. Why is Carl Fogarty here, by the way? Why is he here? He's found the guy who ripped his eye out with barbed wire.
Yep.
I mean, and so he's looking for revenge, and of course. And so everything is a consequence of violence throughout this whole thing. The other prong is it affects his son, Jack, who, you know, after he beats up the two bullies, yes, of course, he totally has that power to do that. You just suddenly start beating ass out of nowhere. But even now, as things have gotten raw, and you know, he gives that, you know, that whole, you know, like, what, we don't solve problems by beating people up. And it's like, no, we just shoot them. He gets immediately slapped from that. And so everything is now just so raw and so elevated that violence has gotten us to this point, basically. Yeah. What used to be very nice and very, you know, this is the happiest family in the world. Now little things like that can cause violence. And then another prong of the consequences is that the violence affects Tom himself. He was happy being Tom until Joey got called out. And now he's struggling to be either Tom or Joey. And as long as he has Joey business to attend to, he will be Joey, which affects his marriage with his wife, who fell in love with a pacifist. And there's a sex scene in this movie that shows the conflicted dynamic of being attracted to violence versus being repulsed by the lies. And that was one of those things where you're like, what's going on here? And it's because they're like literally yelling at each other and slapping each other. And then it turns into sex on the stairs. And then after the sex is done, she's like, oh, what was that? Why did I do that? That's just not me. And then, And then I don't think Jack gets to the point of being able to pull the trigger on Carl if it's not for all of this stuff that he's gone through with the bully and everything. He would probably be like cowered over in a corner the whole time during that scene as well. But even after he's killed Carl, it's not done, because it's connected to this mob violence and everything. And his brother's a somewhat head gangster guy who wants to keep moving up and everything. And it just goes to show Tom/Joey is now realizing that the only way out of this whole situation is you've got to end everybody who knows you're Joey, essentially, hopefully, except not his family, by the end of it. The movie does have sort of a ray of hope at the end of it. It seems like the only person not affected by all of this going on at the end of this movie is his little daughter. His little daughter has been shielded from all the violence. When the stuff going on outside happens, she's, you know, her mom takes her away like a good mom. And you know, by the end of it, when he comes and shows up for that dinner, she's the one who gets the plate for him and everything. The other two, they may have accepted him back in, but I don't think that's an acceptance of, like, you know, it's not, and nothing's going to be the same from this point forward after that. But there is a ray of hope that the daughter was unaffected by this, and maybe he can have like a normal relationship with her as she grows up, and hopefully no more Joey stuff pops up in the middle of all of this stuff. So yeah, this movie has a lot to say on violence, and I thought it was very well done. Although they have to do a lot of these like really unbelievable things, especially with Jack and the bullies, to prove that point. I love Maria Bello so much. I feel like she's one of the most underused actors I've ever seen in my life. This is probably one of my favorite just like wife roles that someone has. Like, it's not just, you know, oh, she's kind of on the sidelines and like, you know, you don't do this, Tom/Joey, don't do this. Like, not doing that. She's in this. She's very present in this. And she, you know, and it reminded me too, like the sexiness of her character reminded me of The Cooler, which is another great movie that she's in and everything. So I love Maria Bello a lot. I think it's interesting Viggo Mortensen went on to do something like this straight after like Lord of the Rings and everything.
Yeah.
You know, he had a long career obviously before Lord of the Rings, and I kept thinking of him in Crimson Tide during this movie for whatever reasons. The way some of his line readings reminded me of Crimson Tide. But I love it when someone like finally, you know, they hit it big with something like that, and then they go on and do all these like very small movies. And he went on to do three movies with Cronenberg after this. But yeah, this is really good stuff.
Yeah, I haven't seen this in a while. It's one of the reasons I wanted to rewatch it for the show, because it has always stood out to me from when I saw it as, you know, one of the greatest movies I've seen. I just remember thinking how amazing it was. As I'm watching it yesterday, as I'm prepping for the show, doing my notes and that kind of stuff, I'm like, oh, this is kind of tropey. It's a little bit tropey. It's a little bit movie tropey. There's a little bit of forced stuff here and there, and doesn't quite all, you know, work for me. That, and I'm starting to get worried. I'm starting to, you know, feel like, oh, maybe this movie isn't as good, you know, as I remember it being. And then it kicks into gear, and I'm just like, no, this movie knows exactly what it's doing. Yes, it's doing some typical movie setup stuff. And yes, the bully stuff is a little bit, you know, overplayed and over the top or whatever. But it's not without a purpose. And, you know, it definitely serves its purpose, because, again, it is about the echoes of violence and lives and how violence begets violence and very rarely begets peace. And so the movie is doing some very purposeful things. And I think I finished the movie thinking, yeah, no, this is one of my favorite movies ever still. I really think the last 20 minutes of this movie is a masterclass on resolution. And it's just, it's so well done. And I don't think I'd seen up until this point a movie that was so efficient with its violence, if you know what I mean. Like in that final scene, the way he dispatches, you know, the henchmen, the bodyguards, whatever, and then even the final, like he doesn't do the monologuing. He does no monologuing. You know, his brother starts to say something, he just shoots him in the head. And I just think there was something about that that was interesting to me, because I think it drew a line in the violence between reveling in it, which his brother did. Richie reveled in the violence. He drew that scene out. He wanted to have a conversation with his brother and let him know that he was killing him, and, you know, and make a big show of it. Whereas the now Tom character, unlike Joey, who probably did revel in the violence, just wants to get it over with, wants it to be done. Which I found really, really interesting. So I think this movie is genuinely smart, genuinely doing some really cool things. I also loved structurally, you mentioned there's always a bigger fish. I think the, you know, the progression of bosses in this movie is also really satisfying. The idea that we start with a real mini boss, those two guys who, you know, shoot up the motel lobby or whatever, and then they're dispatched pretty quickly. And then we get Ed Harris coming in. He's a little bit, he's that, you know, who you think might be the big boss, but he's the medium boss, really. But most of the movie is dealing with this medium boss who is so menacing, so good. And then we get to Richie, who's the big boss, and the reveal that it's his brother, which the first time I watched this movie was a big reveal to me. I was like, oh, you know, like it locked into all these, you know, these things into place for me, as to, you know, kind of what we're dealing with. So yeah, the progression of bosses was definitely compelling to me. I enjoyed the way it structured it that way. Yeah. With that acting trifecta of Viggo Mortensen, Ed Harris, and William Hurt, all three of them are phenomenal in this movie. I love everything about the acting choices all three of them are making. I think Viggo maybe has the most to do, and I don't just mean screen time. I mean with portraying the, you know, the protagonist's journey from this subdued character and then letting Joey come forth. Like, that's an interesting thing to do. And I think he pulls it off really well. But Ed Harris, like, I don't know if it's just him, his presence, like he just has menace written on his forehead. Like, it's just, it's crazy. And then William Hurt, I think, is the best thing about the movie to me, just in that final 10 to 15 minutes. I love every line delivery he has. He almost goes a little bit, Nicolas Cage at times, like just teetering on the edge of like insanity with kind of what he's doing. You know, the how do you F this up moment is just a great movie moment. It's so, I really, really dig his performance here. And then the only other thing I really wanted to talk about was the sex scenes, because I don't think I realized until this time through, how purposeful and thematic those two sex scenes are, how they are setting up us for exactly what, you know, Cronenberg wants us to take away. The first one is all about the innocence of being a teenager, you know, cheerleading and, you know, being teenagers again and all, shucks, what's your dad gonna say, you know, that kind of stuff. And the second one is raw and violent and, you know, discomforting and all those things, and not to get too graphic, but even the sexual acts themselves, like the act that's being performed in the first sex scene is giving, and it's about the other person.
Hey,
and
they're literally 69ing each other in that first one.
So, but I think that's purposeful. That is an absolute purposeful choice, because it's about the other person. It's, and then the second act is so aggressive and taking and violent. And I think we are supposed to believe, at least mostly consensual, but it's one of those things that you definitely see the lines he's drawing with those two scenes to go, this is the difference between how that kind of energy impacts a person and what it makes them do and who it makes them. Mm-hmm. So, this time through, I think, was the first time, you know, the first time I'm watching it, you know, it's, you know, sex scenes, cool, mm-hmm. you know, it's yeah. fine. Mm-hmm. Put them in your movie.
Yeah.
But the second time through, I really became aware of, oh, I see what you're doing here with this. This mm-hmm. makes a lot of sense. So. Yeah.
Well, and then right after that second scene too, there she comes through in this like fully nude scene essentially and walks in, and it's kind of this, it's really interesting because it's like she's walking in front of a stranger and mm-hmm. and but not quite a stranger, and she's like, you're not allowed to see this. This isn't something weird. This is not our relationship at this point, because mm-hmm. she goes right out after that. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really good scene too. A couple of other things in this though, this is sort of on the negative side. We're going back to the bullies and everything. I think the movie is doing a really weird job here at the very beginning with this baseball scene, because the bully, like, I guess apparently believes that if he hits this ball to right field, it's not going to be caught by Jack, because Jack has apparently dropped a bunch of balls before. So don't worry, everybody. My plan is to hit the ball up in the air to Jack and just stand there and watch him drop the ball, I guess.
That has to be it, right? But that's so dumb.
And when he catches the ball, the bully is so upset about this. Come on, man, it's gym class. I understand that, like, you know, they're trying to make it where it's like, okay, this guy gets upset about stuff that's very small, and really not actually anything that's against anyone. It's just playing the game mm-hmm. is all you're doing. I wish there had been a little bit more of a reason for this dynamic. I think we're supposed to believe this has always been this dynamic, and this is just one part of the story. I just wish there was more to it than for us watching the movie than, oh, you caught my fly ball, you think you're big shit, you know, that type of thing. The other thing that's kind of interesting, not interesting, but funny to me, is that so Tom gets all this media attention for shooting those two dudes at the diner, and then he blows away a top Philadelphia gangster in his backyard or his front yard and his two henchmen, and there's not a word about that at all. It's almost like the cop covered it up and they said, I don't know, he must have left town like I told him to. You know, he doesn't get anything from that. And then I don't know if law enforcement will be interested in Tom by the end of this movie when his brother dies and everybody else around him dies and everything. But it's almost like he's kind of getting away with it. And his only real problem is, how do we get the family back together instead of all this bloodshed that he's left in his wake by the end of this movie that would cause all sorts of problems?
Yeah.
There's still gangsters going after him after this, probably, I would imagine.
I mean, you would think so, right? Like, you would think the family is bigger than just that. But yeah, I think the second scene with the cop is supposed to give us a little bit of closure on that, where he's basically like, you know, I just need to know if it's true. And then, you know, Maria Bello's like, he is Tom. He has only ever been Tom or whatever. And mm-hmm. the cop's like, well, all right, I'll go do my job then. And yeah, I think that's supposed to give us closure on that. But yeah.
And is his last name supposed to mean that he is stalled personally? Like, is that what it's supposed to? Because it feels like he has been progressing since he left Joey behind. And I think it's an interesting name to call himself in this, like you stalled your development or something of that nature. Maybe maybe there is no meaning to this name for all I know, but
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask did Cronenberg write this too? I don't even remember looking up who the screenwriter was.
Somebody who adapted it. I can't remember who the name of the guy right now. I can look it up real quick though.
So my point is, if you go back to the original graphic novel, if the name is the same, then you probably just need to ask the person who wrote the graphic novel if it means something. I'm having trouble connecting what it might mean. Tom himself just used the name, at least according to the movie, because it was available, meaning, you know, it was probably somebody he had killed at some point, at least how I took it. So yeah. I don't think he named himself other than he picked the name of somebody. I guess he could pick a specific name because he thought it, you know, meant something to him. But I'm not sure.
Yeah,
not sure
he was of that. Part of that. He was part of that royalty of the Cusack family, man. And now he's he's going on to... Yeah, apparently it was Josh Alson who wrote the screenplay based on a Wagner Locke graphic novel. All right. I think we are ready for our super secret double feature.
Go for it. I love a great deal as much as the next guy, but I'm not going to crawl through a bed of hot coals just to save a few bucks. It has to be easy. No hoops, no BS. So when Mint Mobile said it was easy to get wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of a 3-month plan, I called them on it. Turns out, it's really that easy to get wireless for $15 a month. The longest part of the process was the time I spent on hold waiting to break up with my old provider. To get started, just go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. There you'll see that right now, all 3-month plans are only $15 a month, including the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Find out how easy it is to switch to Mint Mobile and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 GB on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
A lot of movies came through my head, but I'm going to settle on Magnolia for this one. Magnolia is a movie that is about the harm that we inflict on our kids and how that manifests later on in life.
Yeah.
Nearly all the stories in Magnolia have something to do with that. That's what immediately came to mind on this movie, was just the fact that, you know, and in Magnolia, it's all sorts of violence. It's not like actual physical violence. Most of the time, a lot of it has to do with, you know, verbal and sexual and all sorts of different kinds of violence. But Magnolia is the one that came to my mind. So I think that's a good one.
Somebody in the chat mentioned the one that was, you know, rattling around in my head if I were going to pick one, which is Unforgiven, which feels a lot, you know, like the trying to leave something behind, become something else, and then getting dragged back into it.
The very first movie that popped in my head was Quick and the Dead, although I think we've used this before as a super secret double feature, because the Russell Crowe character is also this type of prototype, essentially, because he used to murder a bunch of people. Now he's trying to be a priest, but it's not just about Russell Crowe. That's the only reason why I ended up not picking Quick and the Dead, was just because it's only one tiny theme of that movie.
Right. So. Right. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Next week, the homework for all of us is the movie Gaslight, 1944 movie starring Ingrid Bergman, Joseph Cotten. And yes, this is why we use the word gaslight today. The movie's gaslight has nothing to do with what the definition of that is. It's just the movie has elements to it that's the reason why we define the thing we define as gaslighting. It's about a woman who marries a man who constantly tells her that the things that she sees aren't actually happening. And there's of course a, I'll just stop there. We'll watch the movie and we'll find out together. This movie is fantastic and it stars one of my all timers, Ingrid Bergman. And
so, I love the fact that Josh in the chat is telling us that we've already done this one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks. Yep. Thanks I like for making that. The point.
Exactly. That's a good one. That's a good one. Fuck you. Anyway, I believe small recommend this movie at one point. But we haven't gone the deep dive on it yet. Okay, it looks like we have time for some questions.
Sure.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
Is there an outfit from a movie that you remember well, one you wish you could pull off yourself? And he also says you can, or they also say you can answer superhero outfits here if you really mean it.
Well, I do wish I could pull off superhero outfits, because mm-hmm. you know, those usually require a well-chiseled form, which would be fun to have. But what I picked was every single thing that Robert Sean Leonard is wearing in the movie Swing Kids. Those suits are so cool. I should make one exception, other than the times he's wearing the Nazi youth uniforms. other than those times.
Yes. Yes, indeed. All right. Okay. I had to think about this one for a while because I feel like men's clothing is always kind of samey, and like, what is it out there that, that I've seen where I would like, I'd love to rock that. And I couldn't think of any. So I said, I would love to be able to rock Eva Green's purple dress in Casino nice. Royale and turn all the heads in the room. I dream about this dress, and a lot of it has to do with Eva Green, but I don't think I've been more obsessed with a piece of clothing other than that. So very that's nice. The one that I want to rock, Eva Green's purple dress. Let's see. I don't even remember this question, but I answered it. Please describe to me your perfect taco. Can be any kind of taco, authentic or American.
How dare you insinuate that American tacos aren't authentically American? The taco is one of those things that I really genuinely relate to Taco Bell. I just grew up with Taco Bell. I had friends that worked there. I would go get tacos from there. Their double decker taco, when they came out with that, was one of my favorite things I've ever eaten. Just the simple genius of taking a hard shell taco and then pasting a soft shell taco to the outside of it with refried beans. That's so smart. I really like it. So yeah, that is my answer.
Nothing wrong with that. I love those too. There is a fish taco that I cannot get anymore. There used to be a place around here. It was a chain called Local Taco that had these fish tacos, and it was like a fried cod or something like that with slaw, jalapeno, and bang bang sauce. And basically, I could eat them on repeat like Homer in hell eating donuts. I loved these tacos so much. And then, of course, this place went out of business, or at least the spot that I used to go to is out of business. So I can't eat those tacos anymore. And every fish taco I've had since has paled in comparison. So
I have to say, like, the flour tortilla for me is the perfect food delivery device. Like, we talk about sandwiches a lot, and sure, pieces of bread, and you can put stuff between bread and that kind of stuff. But man, just rolling up yummy stuff in a flour tortilla never gets old, and it works with almost anything. I think it is the perfect food delivery device that you can just like hold in your hand. So yeah, major props to whoever invented the flour tortilla. I love you.
Yeah, absolutely. I give room for one more. I'm going to skip that other food one and go to this next one. We'll get back to that one, but we've already talked about food. So let's go to what's the best concert you've ever seen.
I grew up going to CCM concerts almost exclusively. If CCM is contemporary Christian music, growing up in the church. So I didn't see a lot of concerts that a lot of people would be familiar with during that time in my life where they're going to like hit me the most. So recently, I think what I'd have to say is when I went to Weird Al's No Strings Attached tour, which was our Strings Attached tour, not No Strings Attached, because the strings are attached. That was really cool, not only to see Weird Al do his thing, I think he's genius and so much fun, but also to have a full orchestra backing him up was really, really cool. So I really, really enjoyed that one. So that's my answer.
I have seen a million concerts, and the one that's always going to stick with me is watching Pink Floyd at Vanderbilt back in 1994. That was, I had not been to many concerts at the time of Pink Floyd. I've gone on to see like thousands, but like that Pink Floyd concert was something that this 17-year-old was very happy about. I also saw Muse. Muse is an exceptional live band, and that was that's good on there on the top. And then there was one, you were here in town, but you did not come along. But Manchester Orchestra at the Ryman was a great show as well. Those were all just a few of the concerts that I would say would reach my top. Just going over some of the answers to the questions in the chat, going back to the outfits in movies, Nolan says Rupert Pumpkin suit from the King of Comedy. I can see that. I can totally see that, especially since that is something you would need to quote pull off. George Clooney in Ocean's 11, of course. Clooney in just about any movie that he's in, you want to wear the clothes he's got. Josh says Gozer from Ghostbusters. Every time I try to wear it to work, I get stuff. Yeah, I know, man. It's so see-through and everything.
People have small minds.
Slab says the invisibility cloak from Harry Potter. Link says I would like Iron Man suit. And then there was a lot of taco discussion, but I'm going to skip that. And then we're going to go down to the concerts. Josh says, Gwar. I bet that was an interesting concert.
Wow. Oh. Yeah.
Flyboy says, The Who in Chicago, 1971, maybe? The Who's next? Oh, my God. I'm so jealous. Shaggy Nut says Duran. I actually saw them out here in Nashville one time. Polly says Flogging Molly with like four openers, each better than the previous. Oh,
that's awesome. Always good. Yeah, that's always fun.
Yeah. Slab says only been to SummerSlam 98. Taylor Swift, B-52s, and I don't know, Hatsune Miku. Gotta go with T-Swizzle. Link says best concert I've been to has to be Switchfoot. I don't doubt that. I wasn't a huge Switchfoot fan, but like I bet they were good live.
They when they started, they blew my mind because there's just three of them, and they felt like a 5 to 6 piece band with just the three of them. Like they just had a really, you know, cool way, and they're all really musically gifted. So yeah, their shows are really, really good.
Yeah. Josh also says Primus. I actually saw them recently too, a couple years ago. They were really good. Polly says Tool on the 10,000 Days tour. I recently saw Tool and was disappointed because they did not play very many of the songs that I was, that I knew on that one. That's going to do it for this show. Next week will be Gaslight. And I assure you, we haven't done it before. Thank you, chat, for coming out here and watching us talk about movies, and I guess we'll see you next time.
See you then, guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
And there was a mention in that video of the Country Bears movie, which I had forgotten existed. Which then spurred memories of my childhood going to Disney World and that one section of the Country Bear Jamboree where the guy comes out and sings There's Blood on the Saddle. And it's just the most surreal thing I've ever seen included in a Disney ride. Like, it's just, it's so weird.
Yeah.
There's blood on the saddle. There's blood all around.
I don't remember too much about stuff that I like. I went to Disney World when I was a kid, but I don't remember too much about it. I remember Epcot probably more than I remember Disney World, but and was it Epcot that showed Captain EO, or was it Disney World?
It was Epcot. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember watching Captain EO at Epcot.
Yeah.
So yeah, Disney World, I don't remember too much about. I think if I recall, God, what it seems like I would have been too young for this to happen to me, but I do remember, I believe it's Pirates of the Caribbean that I tried to get on, and I think they have like a little water slide thing, and I was too big to ride the water slide when I was like, I don't know, very young. I'm probably thinking of something a little bit later down the line. Maybe I was like more of a teenager or something, but I don't even remember what that would be.
So there was like a water slide separate from the ride in the park somewhere or something. No, I'm asking you because there's
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. Because I don't think
I can't remember
height limitation on Pirates, but
yeah, there was something. It was something like that. It was a boat of some sort that you got onto, and there was a water slide that went off of it.
That's wild.
My kid brain was like, but there's people who are taller than me that are going down, and you're not letting me. This is unfair.
Your kid brain had logic. Country Bear Jamboree just closed. It is going to reopen in this summer after undergoing a transformation. So yeah, it's
really
yep. Yeah, so yeah, interesting. Yeah, it looks like its final day was in January, and they've been doing a refresh for the last 5 months. So that's wild that came up, and they're like currently under a refresh. But that's the thing, like the Tiki Room did the same thing where they did a refresh of it. It's just like those generational experiences where parents want their kids to have the same experience they did. It must be hard to you know, close those kind of things down. The thing I remember about Epcot was actually right outside the theater where Captain EO played, there are these water fountains, not like drinking fountains, but like, you know, decorative fountains, and it would shoot water like from one to the other, like in these like loops, and it would go like over, you know, walkways and different things, and we just thought that was the coolest thing ever, and we'd try to like block the water and, you know, figure out how they did that, as if, you know, as if it's really complicated to shoot water, you know, but for a kid I was just like, that's magic.
It's kind of great not knowing how things, having any idea of how things work,
and then just
being astounded by it.
Right? You go into that other ride that's right in that section in Epcot. It was like the Wonderful World of Imagination, I think it was called. I have all these memories, but that was just like, that thing blew my mind with the little dragon-like creatures, like called Figment, I think was the creature's name. And then, you know, I took my kids there, you know, when they were younger, and I'm like, oh, this is just a really dumb animatronic ride. Like, what was so amazing about this?
Yeah.
Times change. Yeah.
Did you make the drive from there, or did you fly?
We would drive. The size of our family, flying was just prohibitively expensive. You know, to get six of us, you know, there would have been thousands of dollars than, you know, getting into Disney and all that. But so, yeah, we would do a drive, and we were crazy enough to do a 23-hour drive without a lodging stay. So, like, my wife, yeah, so, like, my wife would take my wife would take the first, you know, part. We would leave, like, at 11 p.m., so we'd do a lot of the night driving first. And mm-hmm. she would get us to morning, and then she'd sleep during the day while I drove during the day.
If you can do that, that's got to be the best way to make that kind of drive, because you have about 7 or 8 hours of just absolutely no traffic whatsoever. It's amazing.
And sleeping children as well. Mm-hmm. So, it works out nice that way. But, yeah.
Yeah. I remember the drive, cause we drove as well when, my parents took me, and, I was one of those kids that was like, are we there yet? Like, it's clear as day. I was one of those kids. I couldn't believe it was taking this long to drive down to this place. And my mom, who's awesome, had this thing where I was like, I would get a new thing to play with after a certain amount of time or whatever, if I was really good, mm-hmm. and, you know, all that type of thing. So, like, so it was kind of an incentive to, I don't know how good I was, but I do remember remarking how I was like, this is taking forever, you know, something like that. We're never gonna get there.
Oh yeah, no doubt. If it weren't for, we called them magic books, I don't know if that's what they were called in gas stations or whatever, but you had the little pin.
Oh, the yes or no?
Yeah.
The yes or no?
Yes. Yeah. The yes or no books where you'd like reveal stuff. They had like a mind game that I used to mm-hmm. love. Like,
those are great.
Yeah, those are great travel books. Of course.
That's what we get at Stuckey's when Stuckey's was a thing. That was the Buc-ee's of the 1980s.
Stuckey's. Yes. Back in my day, we had to color and count cows. Nashville just has the Dollywood is basically the only big theme park around there, right? Do you have a slick Six Flags around, or?
Well, it would depend on what you mean by around there, because Dollywood is a long way away.
Yeah, because that's in Pigeon Forge, right? Or yeah, that area.
You're going past Knoxville, and that's like that's already a 3-hour drive, and going closer.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're going towards the Smoky Mountains mm-hmm. at that point. You're probably going through to Gatlinburg, which is it's on the way to Gatlinburg. It's right next to Gatlinburg, pretty much.
Yeah. Sevierville, Gatlinburg, Pigeon Forge, that whole area. Yeah.
Yeah. Now we used to have Opryland. Opryland was a theme park that was our nice little theme park place. And it was in the mid 90s, I believe they tore it down, and then later on built Opry Mills Mall on top of it. So people in the know go to Opry Mills Mall and go, oh, well, this is where that ride was, and this is where that ride was, and everything. It sucks that it's not here anymore. I don't like the mall whatsoever. I mean, that place attracts a lot of people, that mall. I don't know what, you think malls are dead until you go to Opry Mills. But I kind of wish there was a theme park still around here. It was a kind of a cool, I don't know if I'd still go to it or anything, but every once in a while, I probably would have made a trip.
Well, it's interesting to be local to a theme park. We have Silver Dollar City that's like, you know, a little less than an hour south of here or whatever in Branson. And it's interesting because the season pass stuff is really affordable. Like if you've got a theme park nearby and you're going to go more than once, you should probably just get the season pass. Like it's that cheap. So we just, you know, both my wife and I have season passes, and we just, you know, we'll go down there every once in a while and ride some rides and eat some food and watch people do glass blowing and candy making and all sorts of frontier stuff. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Opryland didn't have like a lot of great rides, like Six Flags. The closest great ride place was Six Flags Over Georgia. You go there, they had some good ones, although a lot of people would go to Kings Island and stuff like that.
Yeah, up in Cincinnati.
That was the big one. And there's a Kentucky Kingdom Six Flags that I've been to before, and it's okay. I don't remember too much about it, but the rides were pretty good. They're okay. They were very beginner level rides at Opryland, and they came out with a couple of new ones there towards the end, but nothing crazy or anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you wanted to get a roller coaster fix, you had to go somewhere else. It was fine. Like I guess as far as a fix was concerned, it was okay. And they also, of course, because it's Nashville, had tons of shows and stuff that you could go to.
Yeah.
I never did that. So
you grew up in the Nashville area then? You're from the area? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Cincinnati would have been, or Kings Island would have been, was Kings Island in Cincinnati? No.
Yeah, it's somewhere around there. It's in Ohio.
It's definitely in Ohio, but now I'm thinking maybe I'm thinking about the Football Hall of Fame. Anyways.
Well, that's
Cantonville.
Was that Cincinnati? That's Canton, yeah.
Yeah.
Canton.
Yeah, Canton. But that's not too, that's just through Kentucky. What's Kentucky, like a 3-hour drive getting across Kentucky?
Yeah, I think that's in Louisville. Now, that place is probably the close. I don't know. Atlanta's 3.5 hours from here.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're I guess you're kind of splitting hairs as far as like, do you go to Dollywood? Do you go to Six Flags Over Georgia? Louisville would be closer, I think, of all those places, because that's like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Two and a half hours.
I remember Kings Island, man, though. Did you ever go to Kings Island when you were a kid?
Never went. Heard all about it from other friends, but never went.
Yeah, I grew up for a while in Ohio for quite a bit of that time. And so we were about the same distance from Kings Island as Cedar Point, which is on the north side of Ohio, which is maybe the greatest amusement park ever, like ride wise. But yeah, Kings Island had the Beast, and it was this wooden roller coaster that just felt like it was just going to fall apart every time you rode it. But the ride itself was like one of the longest roller coaster rides. So it was like a 4-minute ride, which is crazy long for a roller coaster. Because it had two main hills. So you'd do the first, you know, click, 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 click up to the first one. You'd go through all this stuff, and then you'd have another click, 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 click up to the second one, and then go through a whole bunch more stuff. So, yeah, it was interesting.
There was a similar one at Six Flags Over Georgia called the Georgia Cyclone that was a wooden roller coaster, and it had that kind of deal to it. This is probably my last roller coaster experience was 16 years ago, because I was leaving New York, and some friends wanted to go to the Six Flags in New Jersey. And so we went to the Six Flags in New Jersey, and they have a ride there called the King to Ka, which is like apparently it was the tallest roller coaster, or it had some claim to fame.
Yeah, I've heard of that coaster. Yeah.
Yeah. And all day we were going to all these different places, and my eyes kept darting over to the King to Ka. I was like, I want to ride that so much. I want to do it. And at the same time, I don't want to ride this.
Yeah.
I don't. So it's so tall. But I finally got one of the people who was with me to go with me. And that was just such a fun, I mean, it's very simple. It takes you very high up, and then it corkscrews down. And that corkscrew is just one of the most exhilarating things, you know, going down. And then it goes down and it goes back up, and then goes down another hill. But once you do that, the down the hill thing is like, it's basically just a cool down. It's not even really part of the roller coaster.
King to Ka still number one. 456 feet is the first drop. And that opened in May 2005. There's one called Falcon's Flight in Saudi Arabia. But there's not info on that. Maybe that's not open yet. Maybe that's what that is. But it's 640 feet. Insane.
The funny thing about King to Ka was they said something like there, because the speed of the roller coaster may not get you to the top, you have to sometimes back it up to start over again. Can you imagine getting all the way up and then they're like, well, gonna have to back you up now.
The speed may not get you to the top. That's amazing.